The Art of Leadership Network.
First, I had to do my own homework and come and tell my dad what I felt God was saying. And then he'd help me unpack that. And I just, now I look back on the wisdom of that and really marveled at the self-restraint because, you know, if my kid ever wanted to know what my opinion was about something, I was really tempted to tell him because I always had an opinion. And to withhold that and instead say, no, I'm trying to teach you long term to just trust God, not trust your dad. That will do you well for years and years to come.
Welcome to Leaders in Living Rooms. I'm your host, Sean Morgan, bringing you access and insights to leaders and their stories. Hey, podcasters, back at you this week with Dr. Richard Blackaby, the president of Blackaby's Ministries. And you know the Experiencing God Bible Study. It has transformed discipleship around the world. They've just released the Experiencing God Bible, hitting shelves near you in the fall of 2022. But I have to say, the interview, while we do talk about that briefly, and we talk about life growing up in the Henry Blackaby household, what will knock your socks off in this interview is Dr. Richard Blackaby's prowess as a leader. And not just a leader, he's an accomplished leader, but a godly leader. You're just going to be absolutely astounded at what he has to bring. Some of his quotes and the leadership gold that he drops in this interview is incredible. Cannot wait to dive into that with you. Before we do, of course, we want to mention our sponsor, Food for the Hungry. Website is fh.org. If you're a church leader looking for a global ministry partner, I cannot recommend anyone higher than Food for the Hungry. Their church partnership website is fh.org/churches. And I hope you will check them out. If you want to shoot me an email and ask questions or you're intrigued, I'm Sean@theascentleader.org. And I cannot dive into this interview without mentioning The Ascent Leader, which is where we put all of our ministry energy in getting leaders into relational leadership development in leadership cohorts. Check us out at theascentleader.org. And here we go with Dr. Richard Blackaby. All right, podcasters, we are welcoming Dr. Richard Blackaby to the podcast, first-time guest for us, and we got connected because of some new work that his organization has putting out with the Experiencing God Bible. I can't wait to talk about that. I've had a privilege to look through that and get a copy of it, but before we do that, we're going to talk a little bit about leadership and transitions leadership. And Richard, thanks so much for your willingness to dive into our core topic with Leaders in Living Rooms podcast. Tell us a little bit about your life and leadership journey and how that's involved different transitions seasons.
Well, thanks, Sean. It's great to be with you. Most of my life, I've been, it seems, a part of a transition somewhere. My dad, Henry Blackaby, was the pastor of several churches, and every church he went to was kind of down on the mats. It was, had been declining, struggling, and dad always seemed to go to the hard places. He'd build up a church, get it strong and healthy, and then he'd feel called to go to another broken down church. And so that was my childhood growing up, was just being a part of difficult assignments and hard mm-hmm. places. And then just watching my dad just have such a confidence in God that he walked in and, you know, in your flesh, just kind of looking around at what was left, you just thought, Dad, what have you done? Why have you come here? But a few years later, it would be a dynamic, exciting, vibrant place. And so sure enough, when I became, I started my career, it seemed that everywhere I went, three major ministries that I've led, and all of them were on hard times when I got there. But I'd watched my dad, and so a lot of things just kind of came instinctively to me. I don't know that I learned it at school. I just had watched my dad function, and so I just did a lot of the same kind of things. And so I've led a church, I've led a school, now I lead a nonprofit, and all of them I've just taken it for where they were to where I felt like God wanted it to be. And so that's been my career, doing that kind of thing. And I actually kind of really enjoy it. I know some people really like starting things fresh, you know, building it from the ground up. And that is fun to do. But most of my career has been to go to places that needed rebuilding and transitioning. And I actually really, you know, enjoy doing that as well.
When it comes to transitioning, and it sounds like you really got that imprinted on you through the journey of your dad, the blessing and the curse of being a transitions leader. So thanks for pursuing that. When you start out and you're looking at the organization, but you're not the leader, maybe you've been recruited or maybe you're just starting to feel prompted, and you begin to see things that you have questions about. How does a leader in transition, and maybe you're in the seat and you've got the hat on and you're beginning that journey, but I always tell people, you've got the title, but you don't yet have the heads and hearts of your people.
Yeah.
How do you begin to gain confidence in your leadership and what you need to do to the organization to put it on a new path of health and growth when you're still the outsider? Do you tiptoe into certain things, or do you go boldly in certain things? Like, talk to us about how you've led in those seasons and how leadership, I always tell people, sometimes things you've learned in leadership when you haven't been a transitions leader are not great axioms to fall back on when you are a transitions leader. So just talk to us a little bit about those seasons and maybe things that you had to learn along the way or do different because of that season.
Yeah, well, I say for one thing, there's a right thing to do and then there's a right time to do it. And you can actually do the right thing, but do it at the wrong time. And certainly that is the case with transitions, where obviously things have got to be changed. You can't just keep doing what they've always done. But sometimes, because we know something needs to be changed, we try to change it too quickly. And like you say, we don't have the credibility yet. We may be the leader, but they don't know that they can trust us. And I've come into situations where there were others who had been there before me, and they tried to change something and it didn't work. And so now I come in and they've got some skepticism. Well, we've had three other guys just like Richard come in, and they all talked a big game too, and then it never worked out. And so, are we going to go through this again? And so, a couple things I would just say. One is, ultimately you're leading people, not organizations. And so we get that wrong sometimes. We just think, well, if I'm leading, it's almost a kind of a sterile kind of situation where we're just going to adjust this organization. We're going to change this culture. We're going to tweak operating procedures, whatever. But at the end of the day, you're actually leading people, and they all have their own journey. They've got their fears and insecurities and their own baggage. And so you've got to have people skills to do that. You can't just fire off a bunch of memos and change a place. You've got to connect with the hearts of your people. And so, whenever I've come into a new place, I've always taken time to sit down and listen to people, just ask questions, not come in as the boss and start barking out orders and saying, we're going to change things here now that I'm here. More it's like, tell me about what you've been going through. Tell me the challenges you've had. Tell me, what problems do you see that are going to need to be addressed? And just do a lot of listening. Doesn't mean you're not going to be active. I mean, everywhere I've ever gone, I've changed everything from top to bottom. But I began by just really getting my bearings if you listen to people, you immediately build a trust. Walls will come down. You'll at least get some initial hearing if you just listen, first of all. But secondly, you can't underestimate the power of small victories. And so some guys are always, they walk in and the first day on the job, they're looking for a home run. And, I think they're swinging for the fence, but they don't even really know the lay of the land yet. And so far, far better to just start off just getting some small wins. And, don't try to tackle the deep rooted issues on week one. Kind of clean up some obvious stuff, and there always will be obvious stuff. I remember I became the seminary president of a school in Canada, and it had been neglected and so many things needed to be done. I mean, from top to bottom, it just, everywhere you look, there were huge needs. And I got there in August, and classes are going to be starting soon. And I mean, I looked around, and the building and grounds guys, they love to fix engines on tractors and, you know, all kinds of behind the scenes mechanical stuff, but like they had no eye for aesthetics. And so, I mean, they had just neglected the grounds. And so they literally were like 3 foot high thorn bushes all growing up around the parking lot and the building that they just hadn't gotten around to weed eating and cleaning up. And because they were trying to fix this backhoe or something in the shed. And so I remember it was the first week there, and about the third day after I'd kind of, you know, done my walkabouts and talked with folks, I just took an afternoon. I just went myself. I'm the president. I went and got a weed eater and went around the whole property just cleaning up the, and of course, I only did that once. It wasn't like I was going to start being the groundskeeper every week, but I just want to make a statement. We got people visiting our campus right now, trying to decide if they're going to come as a student. We can't wait for 3-4 weeks and just have an eyesore around here. Like let's start making things look nicer. And I got a lot of mileage out of that. I mean, I was just trying to get the job done, but everybody saw, boy, the president cares about how this place looks. Even if he's got to go and do it himself, we're not going to be careless about our appearance anymore. And that sent all kinds of messages. All it did was, you know, I cleared out a bunch of weeds around the parking lot and around the building, but it just sent a message already. Hey, things are already looking nicer around here, looking cleaner around here. And, you take care of a bunch of obvious low-hanging fruit early on. And then, I mean, we tackled big stuff later and faculty issues and accreditation and starting new programs. I mean, we got to the big stuff, but there's so much little stuff, you know, you can do in the early days where people just start to notice. They come in the building and it's like, looks neater, cleaner, more cared for than it used to. And you start to realize, you know what, ever since that guy's been here, things just have looked nicer and are more organized. And they start to get a feel of like, hey, this guy makes things better. So he's already done 10 small things. Now he's asking us to do a bit of a bigger thing. Well, he's 10 for 10 out of everything he's done so far. Maybe we can trust him with this bigger effort now. So, you know, lots of things I've kind of learned, but make sure you're connected with the people. Take time to, don't be so busy trying to turn things around that you neglect the people you've got to work with. And then just start tackling the small stuff you can knock off quickly. Build up a resume, a track record of success, and then you can gradually start tackling bigger and bigger things that ultimately need to get changed as well.
Yeah, that's so good. There's really almost a day's worth of change management lessons in what you just said. I think the small things that you can chip away at are so good, because if you do go for a big change first, the truth is it's a huge risk because it better go well. It's a sink or swim thing. But if you're chipping away at some of these smaller wins and you get 3 or 4 or 5 and then you don't get one, that one's not going to get a target painted on your back necessarily.
Yeah. And the other thing too about small, I found about small things is that like you don't, it's kind of like taking you bought a used car or something and you want to take it out on the road and see what it'll do right away. Well, probably good to drive it around the neighborhood for a bit first and just figure out, you know, that the mirrors are set right and your seats and I've just kind of found, you know, sometimes if people have done big things right off the bat, they didn't really know what the culture would sustain yet. I mean, they didn't know who the power brokers were. They didn't know if there was someone that would just try to nix whatever you did. Mm-hmm. But when you do some smaller things, it's like test driving your car. It's like, okay, when we did this, was there someone over there that got their feelings hurt because we did it this way, not that way? We didn't talk to them first, or we didn't communicate like we should have. Okay, well, before I do a big thing, I'm going to know how to address some of this, and I'm going to get the right team in place, and we're going to communicate in a way everybody's okay with. And okay, now I think we can go a little further. But it's like doing a space launch, you know, right off the bat with a rocket, and you haven't even just, you know, done some basic things yet. Take care of all the, you know, test drive it a bit, try some smaller things till you get a good feel for it. And then you're much safer at tackling a bigger thing.
Yeah. The other thing I heard in there that I think is a great lesson, Richard, is there's 10 things we could talk about clipping the thorns. But you didn't, you weren't changing anything. You weren't coming in with a new strategy or a new playbook. You were helping them see that they had become numb to maybe observing where they weren't running their own playbook very well.
Right.
Right? Like, this is a right. university. How new students observe us and feel here is a critical part of our success in getting the right students here. And if we're not doing that, you're sort of, you're not coming in and making a change. It's more an evaluation of their own ability to be successful with their own tools and strategies and playbook. And I think that's really genius in the early days to do that. Let me ask one other question along those lines. I think that, in every season of transition, there's always a fresh set of eyes, right? You've got a new leader. I work with a lot of leaders that follow their fathers, primarily as lead pastors in local churches, but in other organizations as well. There's a desire to honor those who have gone before you, but there's also a natural restlessness to get the organization on a new path of health and growth forward. And sometimes you can be cleaning up a mess that somebody else, and let's face it, our successors, yours and mine, everybody's listening, they'll all clean up a mess or two that we didn't.
Yeah.
Whether it was just a blind spot or a laziness. So what I love about the way we get to hold these transition conversations is that we're not just talking about the bright, shiny, easy stuff and the fun stuff with transition. We're talking about the more practical side. But how do you make an adjustment that ultimately was somebody else's problem that you inherited or something that wasn't done, but yet still honor, maybe not even just your predecessor, but the leaders who went before you and created the potential for this organization to be what it is?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of insecure leaders out there, and if you're insecure, you're gonna feel threatened by the guy, your predecessor. But I just tell people, you're never gonna do yourself any good by tearing down the guy before you, by criticizing them. You don't want to start off your leadership journey negatively. And so even just something as simple as just, you know, weed eating thorn bushes and things. What I was trying to say is I didn't build this this parking lot. Someone else did. And all I'm trying to do is bring it back to its pristine, what it used to be. I'm trying to make it as good as it was. This isn't my project. And so, you know, the first thing you kind of want to do is just say, listen, the people who built this building or this program, they had a vision for it. All I'm trying to do is get it back to its former glory and its success and make it the best it can be. And so that's not critical. That's saying, hey, I'm embracing what you've done, and I just want to get it back to the where it used to be and how good it could be. And that doesn't mean you can always keep it around if it's a program, but you at least start off by affirming what's there and trying to make it as good as it can be. But, you know, I followed my dad in the ministry I'm in now at Blackaby Ministries International. And I kind of walked that fine line because people just revered my dad. People thought he was the greatest man of God they'd ever known. But he was not he certainly was not a hands-on administrator by any means. He was traveling the world and just had staff that were pretty loosely supervised and needed attention and needing, development. And so when I came in, what he stood for and his message, well, I tell you, I didn't want to tinker with that. Like that was bedrock. But, you know, he was not known for being his administration. Nobody came and said, would you please mentor me to administer the way you do? So I thought, okay, well, those areas I think I can certainly address without in any way diminishing his walk with God and his teaching and so on. And so I took great pride, really. And, you know, I still really delight every time someone comes to me and says, because I've been leading this ministry now for 16 years. And so people will still come up and say, Richard, I really appreciate how you honor your father and what you do. Well, I've totally gutted the entire organization. I mean, the organization today is nothing like it was when he led it. But the message that he promoted, we're still promoting as widely as ever and promoting it. And my dad's teaching, his preaching and so on, we're still getting it out there available to people. And I always speak very highly of my father and mother wherever I am. And so, you know, what people see and hear is honoring to my predecessor. But as we move into the future, the wheels and nuts and bolts, those have been replaced and updated, but people don't typically even see those. So, you know, there is a way to kind of update things without having to diminish and, you know, put down the people before. Even if you have to fix the messes that you inherited, you don't have to, you know, blame them or throw them under the bus because they left this mess. Because like you said, one day people will be coming in and cleaning up our messes. And so I always felt like, look, just behave in such a way that you'll want people to treat you one day. And if you were gracious to the one that you followed, hopefully the one who follows you will be equally as gracious to you one day.
Did you ever run into situations where you were on that path and being pretty intentional about it, but then somebody on your team maybe criticizes past leadership or even criticizes past leadership with a backhanded compliment? So I was working with a leader recently and he told me that a lot of people on his staff were saying, oh, it's so refreshing to have that kind of leadership here and this, that, and the other, and sort of complimenting him. And I told him, I said, well, can I give you some advice? And he said, yeah. And I said, what you permit, you promote. And if you permit them to say something like that, ultimately it's a criticism about your professor, your predecessor. And you've just promoted it. And you cannot let that culture develop of maybe getting in good with the new leader by climbing over somebody else, in this case, your predecessor or somebody else who's not on staff. Do you ever inherit people like that? And I have a follow-on question where I think where this might be headed, but I'm just curious, first question there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a great point. And one thing I would just say, that's seductive. You know, whenever anyone turns to you and says, oh, I'm so glad you're here, you know, because boy, it's so much better now that you're here and doing that. And you're right. It's a backhanded sort of slap at the guy before you, but just beware, because however people treat the person before you, that's the person that follows you, they'll probably be saying the same thing about you. And I know, like, I've talked a lot with pastors and you know, when they would come into a church and someone would just be totally bad-mouthing the previous pastor, I said, just be careful with that, because that tells you more about the person than about the former pastor. And sure enough, they'll be talking that way about you and trying to ingratiate themselves with your successor one day as well. And at the same time, if you arrive and people are coming up and they're speaking very highly of the guy before you, don't be intimidated by that. Don't feel threatened by that. What it may mean is they love their leaders. They support them, and they'll support you as well. And they'll be talking highly about you one day to whoever follows you. So I've just kind of learned, be careful. We kind of always, sometimes it stokes our ego a bit when people tell us how much better we are than the last guy. But be careful, because you don't really want to foster that kind of culture where we're criticizing anybody, you know, and certainly not ingratiating ourselves to people in power. You don't want to foster that, even if it does make you feel good in the moment.
You talked about culture. I almost feel if you really want to make change in culture, you're going to have to change some things with people. That doesn't mean summarily firing or things like that, but it probably certainly means some restructuring, but probably likelihood there are some people where if you really want to move the culture needle, they're not going to be a part of the organization. Yeah. I led in the military for 26 years and made some enemies that I'd look back and go, I probably would have done overall the same thing, but I would have done it in a much loving and kinder way than I did. And maybe at a pace that was different, thinking like what you said, I'm not leading an organization, I'm leading people. But going back to that core statement of, if you really want to change culture, you're going to have to probably change people, move people, adjust people, maybe do some hiring and firing. You feel like that's true, or have I given up too soon on the team that I inherit?
Well, you know, you always want to give people the opportunity. You want to lead with grace, I think, and at least don't walk into a place and immediately start lopping off heads everywhere. I would, you know, present kind of a picture of a vision of the kind of place you intend for this to be and where you're headed, and invite people to join the journey and, you know, give them every opportunity to adjust and walk with them and train them and do one-on-ones with them. But the reality is too, there are just some people that are just unwilling to change. And there are some people that are just chronically negative, critical, disruptive. And it doesn't take very many of those kind of people to really sour a culture. You know, you try to have a team meeting and you got one person that's just a naysayer about everything. It just, you just watch it just, you know, just sucking the air out of the room, and you can't get a real positive, upbeat kind of meeting or feel because this guy's always pointing out the negative. And I've tried to work with folks like that, but at a certain point, if you really want a dynamic, upbeat, positive culture, you know, there, if people aren't willing to make adjustments and to become that kind of team player, you have to be aware. You don't want to be too insensitive to an individual, but you certainly don't want to, like, if you don't address that, then everybody else pays the price. You know, you've got 10 mm-hmm. people on your team suffering because you don't want to hurt the feelings of one person that doesn't want to change. And I would always say you've got to always protect the majority, the team at large, and not at the expense of trying to just pacify one or two naysayers. And so, you know, at a certain point, I've just seen how quickly one or two bad apples can just ruin a good team or a good culture. And I care too much about the organization to just endure forever people with bad attitudes. So, you know, you start with grace, but I think if you're really going to be a guardian, a protector of the organization, then you've got to protect it from people that are just going to harm it in some way.
Yeah, that's so well said about how negativity and the wrong attitudes and resistance can really harm so many others on the team and inhibit your ability. I've talked to so many leaders who have said, when the day I let that person go, they were gone by 2 p.m. And the time from 2 p.m. to when everybody left that day, you could feel the difference in our team.
It's amazing how impactful some negative people can be. I remember as a pastor, I hated to lose anybody from my church, but there was this one woman that was just, I look back now and I just say she was just an evil person. She was just evil. And she just exuded this evil, negative kind of presence. And I remember she got upset about something and left the church. Basically, she got upset because we were just getting too holy around there. The Spirit of God was really moving and the light was shining and there was no dark corners for her to kind of hide in anymore. And so she left. And I remember there was a brand new believer, real enthusiastic young woman. And the very next Sunday, she came up to me. The first Sunday that this other evil woman wasn't there, this new person came in and just said, "Richard, Pastor, I don't know what it is, but it just, things feel so different in there. The worship was just so upbeat." And there was just, she said, "Is there something different?" And I didn't bother to say, "Well, there is something different. There's someone wasn't in the room today." But you literally, I literally could feel just the tangible difference sometimes when a negative influence is removed. And then you're thinking, why was I so agonizing about losing someone like that? I think God was actually trying to move them on just to free up the church to become all that God intended it for it to be.
How does the phrase "be slow to hire and quick to fire" parlay into that?
Well, you know, if you take your time to do due diligence in your hiring in the first place, you won't have to do a lot of firing. A lot of the firing we do is because either we inherited someone that should never have been hired, or we just hired too quickly. And so if you don't want to do a lot of firing, just hire well in the first place. But at the other hand, the moment that you sense as a leader that there's someone that's just going to have to go, you see their attitude, you see their spirit, you see the way they treat others, or maybe they have an ethical issue, an honesty issue, a work ethic issue. There's just a lot of chronic character kind of stuff that once you identify that, it's just, you're not, the longer you keep negative people around you like that, you're not helping yourself at all. It's just, you're missing opportunities every day, or you're allowing more damage to be done every day until you remove that negative person. So it seems pretty harsh. I mean, I haven't just done wholesale firings, but there have been times where it just became obvious that this person mm-hmm. Does not have the capacity to become what we need them to be, or just a complete unwillingness to adjust to that. So I can fire them today, or I could fire them a month from now, but what opportunities will be lost in that month while I endured another month of frustration with this person? Yeah. So, you know, and of course it takes courage to lead. And part of the courage is just the courage to do the hard things. That's where, why you get paid the big bucks as the leader, is when you got to do the hard thing and take the flack. When I remember firing a professor one time, and I knew I was going to lose some students. I knew people would leave the school because of that. Even though the person desperately needed to be fired, had to be fired, I still knew that it would cost me, and people would go around bad-mouthing me. And it was something I could have probably pawned off to someone else to do. But I thought, well, there's going to be a lot of negative flack. I'll take that one on my shoulders, but it's going to have to be done. And so better to be done now than a month from now. Putting off things, and just in general, whenever a leader puts something off that they know they need to do, usually nothing good comes from delaying.
Yeah. I think one of the things that we're sort of dancing around here is this idea that being a good leader, at least in our eyes, is also being a biblical leader. There's biblical qualities there. So let's shift gears a little bit to talk sure. about this Bible that you guys have put out. It's a Christian Standard Bible. It's got content added, really chapter summaries and some great questions and things like that. So I want to talk about that, what's different about it, what's helpful, but why don't you just start with helping us understand where you saw the need in Christendom for this work?
Yeah, well, it's based on the very popular study, Experiencing God. And Experiencing God was a study that just helped people go beyond just knowing about God to actually experiencing Him as a person that was mm-hmm. interactively involved in your life. And it was just life transformative. I mean, I never have a week go by, it seems, where I don't have people telling me how God used that material to change their life. And so there was a real desire to say, well, you know, people take that study and it's helpful. It's a 12-week study, but then they're done and they'll say, well, what else is there out there? Because it just seemed like life is constantly draining me spiritually and emotionally. Right. And I need to be experiencing God every day. And so this Bible is an attempt to say, well, you can. I mean, every day as you're studying the Bible, we'll just fill this Bible's pages up with helping you to be able to experience God in these pages, no matter where you turn. So every day of the year, as you're in God's Word, you're not just doing a Bible reading; you're having an encounter with the author of the Bible. And I tell you, when you lead, especially in these days, there's just a lot of circumstances of people that can really drain you and bewilder you and discourage you. And, you know, you've been second guessed and third guessed about the decision you made, and you're really going through the feeling drained and unsupported or whatever else. But then you pull your Bible out in the morning and you just draw near to God and you begin to encounter God. It's amazing as a leader how you can have new hope, new confidence. There's nothing like an encounter with God to change your perspective and give you hope again.
That's incredible. You started this project when?
Well, during COVID, this Bible had been out years before, and had, you know, like a lot of Bibles, eventually just sort of ran its course and ended. They stopped publishing it, and during COVID, they came back to me and said, you know, we get so many people asking if we're ever going to pull this back. but we'd love just to give it a complete overhaul. We just add a lot more material and refresh it and modernize it. And I had about 100 trips canceled as a speaker during COVID, and I was still traveling, but just not nearly as much. So I just thought, well, God, I really want to redeem the time, and so I'll take this on and I'll update this Bible. We've really been pleased how it has come out, and just the number of tools there now to help people experience God every day. I wanted to look back on COVID and not just see all the things I wasn't able to do. I wanted to fill it up. I wanted to find you can always look at the problems, but I wanted to look at the possibilities behind the problems and say, well, with more time, I could either complain I'm not traveling as much, or I could say, hey, since I wasn't traveling so much, I was able to produce a really quality new product that I can be happy about.
And why this version? Why the CSB? Is there anything significant there for you
Lifeway
personally?
Lifeway produced this version, Lifeway Christian Resources. It's a newer translation. It's a conservative one, it's a conservative take of the scriptures. And for the most part, you know, I've used a couple of different translations over the years. And I think it's good to actually probably draw on a couple of different ones. But I've generally been pretty pleased with this one. It's a fresh, a modern, conservative translation. So I feel good about it. It's a good one. I think you can feel pretty safe with the way they handle the translation and the Word of God.
Your father did the original Experiencing God study 30 plus years ago. Tell us how that impacted you at that time, or, you know, within a few years of that work beginning to be released.
Well, you know, my dad for years taught Experiencing God before he ever wrote it. You know, when he wrote it, it was almost an accident. I mean, the publisher heard him speaking about it and said, we got to get this in print. We've never heard anything like that. And Dad was too busy. They had to track him down and follow him around and listen to him speak in conferences. But I'd grown up with it. So, I mean, what I read and experienced in God was not new to me. That's what I'd grown up assuming that's how everybody lived their Christian life. So it wasn't like I learned something new, but what I did notice was, how impactful it was to others. And I'd be in a meeting and I'd hear Dad preach. I think, yeah, I know all that stuff. I've heard it all my life, but people would just be coming apart in the auditorium and Dad would be halfway through the sermon and people would already be coming up to the altar and praying and weeping and just undone by what they were hearing. So I've been in communist countries, I've been in Muslim countries and encountered people that because of Experiencing God, they'd started a church or they had a huge ministry. I've just seen the power of those truths. I always knew it just in my own growing up, but then to see it worldwide, that any culture, any country, any circumstance, and these truths can be just dramatically impactful, really opened my eyes just to how much people need to hear these truths.
The name of our podcast is Leaders in Living Rooms, and that really comes from the core of our ministry is getting small groups of pastors, 6 to 10 pastors in a cohort and learning from another leader in their living room or living room environments, because we feel like leaders will tell stories and tell versions of stories in an unrecorded small circle of trusted people that they won't tell anywhere else. And there's a lot of leadership learning in the story behind the story. But I'm curious. So Leaders in Living Rooms is a metaphor for us. Do you have a great living room memory as a child, or maybe seeing your dad as a granddad to your children that you can share with us?
Yeah, well, lots of stories. You know, when I was growing up, we didn't have a lot of money. We were in a mission setting, kind of by faith. And we had a pretty small house. My dad didn't, you know, he had 5 kids and we always had out of town guests staying with us. So dad didn't have an office. He had an office at the church, but I just remember the living room kind of became Dad's office. And a lot of the time when he was home, he was probably there and he always had his Bible and note iPads and books sitting there by his chair. So I knew that if Dad was home, all I had to do was go in the living room, and I was kind of entered his office. But it didn't matter how early you got up. I mean, he was usually up by about 4 o'clock in the morning. And so no matter how early you got up, there'd already be a light on in the living room, and he was already meeting with God. And that was very comforting and stabilizing for us, I think, just knowing no matter how early you got up, Dad was up earlier and he was already meeting with God. And so you kind of walked into the living room and there was almost this, it was like holy ground, you know, like Dad had been meeting with God for 3 hours when I got there. And so when you asked him a question or sought guidance, you just knew that what you were going to hear was not my dad's opinion. It was a word from God. And I really felt like people don't need my opinion. My opinion, I would never want anyone to base their life on my opinion. You want to base it on a word from God. And so I have so many memories of that. And then if I did come and ask for, you know, his advice, he would typically say, well, what do you think God is saying to you about that? And I would say, well, you know, I'm not sure yet, but I want to know, Dad, what you think. And he would typically steer me back to God. And I remember later asking him about that. And he said, well, Rich, I did that for two reasons. One is because God's a lot smarter than I am. He knows a lot more. So I could give you my opinion, but that would be a second-rate opinion compared to God's. Sure. And he said, besides that, he said, you know, I won't always be around available for you, but God will be. So I can either teach you to always come to me when you have a question, or I could teach you to always go to God. And if you learn to go to God with all your questions, you'll always be able to do that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I respected that. I wanted to know what he thought, but he was very careful not to typically lead with that. You know, I could probably eventually get some of his thoughts and his opinions, but he never wanted to start with that. He always wanted to drive me back to God. And first I had to do my own homework and come and tell my dad what I felt God was saying. And then he'd help me unpack that. And I look back on the wisdom of that and really marveled at the self-restraint, because, you know, if my kid ever wanted to know what my opinion was about something, I was really tempted to tell him, because I always had an opinion. And to withhold that and instead say, no, I'm trying to teach you long term to just trust God, not trust your dad. That will do you well for years and years to come.
Thank you, Richard. This has been a masterclass on leadership. Thank you for this work. I love that this work came out of the time that you got back. You were gifted the gift of time during the pandemic. It's Experiencing God Bible, Knowing and Doing the Will of God. And you can find it anywhere books are sold. So we hope you will pick this up. We hope this will enrich your life as a listener and maybe through your leadership even affect your church. But once again, Richard, thanks for being on the show with us.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Hey, leaders, I hope that was helpful to you, regardless of your level of leadership, whatever hat you're wearing in the organization, the church, or the ministry that you're leading in. Dr. Richard Blackaby definitely leaned in and brought some great stuff. I do want to encourage you, hit us up at theascentleader.org. What we do there in getting leaders into relational leadership development is absolutely critical to thriving as a healthy leader. I hope you'll check us out at theascentleader.org. Wow. Leaders, thank you so much for tuning in. We are just blown away by all the things that you guys tell us that this is doing to grow you and develop you. And I'll tell you what, if you feel like this is growing you as a leader, as a person, as a pastor, we would be honored if not only would you continue to listen, but if you would subscribe, if you would get on social and say something so that the people you have influence over can see the ways that this is benefiting you and that they would check us out as well. That would mean the world to us. Thank you so much for listening.